What does it mean to remember? What does it mean to give the nameless a story? What does it mean to tell history with humanity? Hello and welcome to the podcast, Our Shared History, War Personnel of the Commonwealth Remembered, the podcast from the German War Grave Commission Regional Association, Berlin. I'm Holly Perel, intern at the German War Grave Commission in Berlin and student at the University of Leeds in the UK. I'm leading the research project, Our Shared History, War Personnel of the Commonwealth Remembered. The aim of the project is to find biographical information about the fallen from the Commonwealth so that the fallen, no matter whether soldier or civilian, are remembered as people instead of statistics. In every episode of the podcast, I will tell the stories of the fallen buried in the former British occupation zone of Berlin. It is my intention that their stories are told with humanity, respect, and compassion. For every story told in this podcast, I will visit the 1935 to 1945 Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery in Berlin and lay the fallen a white rose. The white roses symbolise not only remembrance and gratitude, but also humanity. The majority of the biographies in this project detail the lives of servicemen from the air forces. The bombing of cities was instrumentalised by both sides of the conflict as a weapon against the civilian population. Although I primarily focus on Berlin in this project, it goes without saying that it was not just German cities that were affected by bombings. The first bombings took place in 1939, in which the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, flew over Warsaw and Rotterdam. From May 1940, the British Air Force, the RAF, initiated the first airborne attacks on German cities. On the 14th of November 1940, the German Air Force launched a devastating air raid on Coventry in the West Midlands of the UK, under the codename Unternehmen Mondscheinsonate, Moonlight Sonata. One of the heaviest bombings of Berlin took place on the 3rd of February 1944. Of a total of 958 planes of the United States Army Air Forces, USAAF, 939 broke through the German defence lines. We're talking here about heavy bombers armed with 10 to 12 men. When you take a moment to calculate how many people were actually in the skies, it is between 9,580 and 11,469. The nightmarish images from the war in the Ukraine make you feel the agony of these people even more, and it suddenly all seems so much more real, even though it was 78 years ago. At 78 years, the Second World War will soon be almost three generations past. 78 years is a lifetime. What would these people have had to say about this time? Their lives? And here we return to the central tenets of the project. Is it possible to remember as a collective? Is it even possible to remember together in friendship? What is the role of the political and the personal in cultural memory? Is collective memory possible when our national narratives are so different? All my life, I've been interested in German-British relations throughout history. Since my school days, I've been fascinated by the prejudice against the German language in Britain, even in our education system. Why is it that German is still portrayed as aggressive in British media? I'm often asked why I learned German. French and Spanish students do not receive the same questions. I think it is a shame that in the UK this prejudice is still so visible in our society, especially when the UK could learn so much from Germany and its approach to cultural memory. We have our own guilt, and despite the development of post-colonial thought and such movements as Why Is My Curriculum White and Black Lives Matter, the role of colonialism in our history is still a very contentious issue. We have a lot of work to do ourselves to come to terms with our past. Sometimes it feels as if the prejudice against other countries is often taken as a convenient excuse not to confront our own history in Britain, our own guilt. Since the Brexit referendum, I've become very concerned about my own country. It is my sense that we've developed a dangerous cultural amnesia in which history is told with a convenient selectivity. In my opinion, the Brexit vote was a confirmation of this amnesia, an attack on the establishment of a transcultural memory, a cultural memory without borders. With this project, I want to bring together the cultural memories of the UK and Germany. It is my belief that peace is a matter of cooperation. To remember collectively means to overcome borders, to bring people together, and to fight against hatred and prejudice. Talking to each other, reaching out to each other, getting to know each other, away from politics and news, and knowing each other's stories helps in this. Therefore, I would also like to take you with me to tell the stories that may, as of yet, be unknown to you. In each episode of the podcast, you will hear two stories of the fallen from the Commonwealth and two interviews with experts in the field of cultural memory. This episode is all about how history connects us. Of course, history affects us all. That is why it is important to understand the connection between personal history and the larger national narrative. In other words, where exactly is the line between the individual and the nation, between personal and political issues? To explore this issue in more detail, I would like to share a couple of biographies of the fallen from the Commonwealth that offer some insight into this issue. The first story is about Lancaster Squadron 625, which was led by Sergeant Roy Gallop. First of all, I'd like to start with the history of the squadron itself. Sergeant Gallop joined the squadron on the 28th of November 1943. At this time, the flying squadron consisted of Bombardier Sergeant P. Rawlings, Flight Engineer Sergeant F. Rawstron, Navigator Sergeant F. D. Price, Radio Operator Sergeant P. Moylan, Sergeant W. G. Jones, and Tail Gunner Sergeant D. G. Whiteman. Sergeant Gallop flew to Berlin with Sergeant E. S. Ellis as pilot. In the course of the operation, two men from the squadron were injured and had to be taken to hospital in Rossby in England. On the 16th of December, Gallop attempted to complete the operation with replacement machine gunners. However, the operation had to be abandoned at 1700 hours when the aircraft could not fly close enough to drop the bomb safely. On the 1st of January 1944, the squadron flew to Berlin despite severe weather. Bombs were dropped over Berlin at 17 minutes past 3 in the morning. During the night, the severe weather only worsened. Reports described a strong thunderstorm in which the engine of the aircraft froze. As a result, the aircraft went into a spiral dive and dropped from 19,500 to 3,000 feet. That's dropping from 5,943 to 940 metres. Despite these challenges, the aircraft landed at Woodbridge. On the 30th of January, the flying squad took part in its last operation. Two men from the squadron were replaced with Sergeant S.J. Harrison and Flight Officer A.J. Norman. Two men from the original squadron were offered to another squadron as volunteers. And strangely, these two squadrons were intimately connected, as they took the same bus to work every day. At 16:52, the Lancaster bomber KE-7683 flew from Kelstern to Berlin. Approximately 3 hours later, another plane crashed of the same description. Witnesses stated that the bomber was shot down and thereafter exploded near Linham, a village 30 miles northwest of Berlin. Of the two squadrons, the following men were killed: Pilot Roy Gallup, age 18, Sergeant Stanley John Harrison, age 21, Navigator George Arthur Prigg, age 23, Air Bomber Peter Rawlings, age 23, Sergeant Patrick Moylan, age 21, Air Gunner Alexander James Normandon, age 23, Air Gunner David Walser Thomas Johnson, age 30. Sergeant Nixon was later killed on the 25th of March 1944 when his aircraft was shot down by Oberlieutenant Martin Drews. 2 weeks later, Sergeant Ashurst and his squadron tragically lost their lives while flying over Denmark. The linked stories of the air squadrons convey the symbolism of the crest of Squadron 625, which consists of a golden chain. When a colleague loses his life, it is as if one link in the chain breaks and the other links follow shortly after. I've chosen this particular story because the squadron's lifelines are so intimately connected by a strong camaraderie that will never be forgotten. But who were these men? Flight Sergeant Roy Gallup was the son of Baker William G. Gallup and Louisa J. Gallup Nee Pickett, and was born on the 23rd of February 1925 in Essex in the United Kingdom. Gallup had three siblings: William L. C. Gallup, George P. Gallup, and Joan L. Gallup. During his youth, Gallup worked in his father's local bakery. Gallup joined the Royal Air Force when he was only 16 years old. He completed his training as a pilot in Class 42J in the USA. Gallup is believed to have been the youngest member of the 620 squadron to perish. He was only 18 years old. Born in 1923 in Devon in the south of Britain, Flight Sergeant George Arthur Prigg was son of the plumber George Bernard Prigg and Mabel Florence Prigg Nee Hawker. At the age of 20, Prigg married Phyllis M. Collins at the local church in Honiton, a small town in the county of Devon in the UK. Prigg was a loved organist in his church and later directed one of the choirs at St. Peter's Cathedral in Exeter. Warrant Officer David Walter Thomas Johnson was born on the 18th of April in 1913 in Newport, Monmouthshire in South Wales. He was the son of Walter Thomas Johnson, a stonemason, and Mary Maud Johnson. Johnson had two sisters, Beatrice M. Johnson and Muriel S. Johnson. Before beginning his career in the Royal Air Force, Johnson worked as an accountant at an insurance company. During his career in the Royal Air Force, he took part in several operations in North Africa, in the squadrons number 38 and number 40. On the 29th of January 1944, he was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for the length of his military service. This award was even featured in the British newspaper, the London Gazette. Flight Sergeant Patrick Moylan was born on the 28th of January 1923 in Gunnedah, Australia. He was a son of Hugh John Moylan and Doris Elizabeth Moylan. He was an accountant before joining the Royal Australian Air Force. Moylan's name can also be seen on the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, the capital of Australia. His name is on plaque number 127. Flight Sergeant Roy Gallup, Warrant Officer David Walter Thomas Johnson, and Flight Sergeant Patrick Moylan are all buried at the 1939 to 1945 Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery in Berlin. Today I present Flight Sergeant Roy Gallup, Warrant Officer David Walter Thomas Johnson, and Flight Sergeant Patrick Moylan with a white rose in the Berlin 1939 to 1945 Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery. You are not forgotten. Before we hear the next story, in the second part of the podcast, we have an interview with Dr. Jonas Andersen. Dr. Jonas Andersen is a research associate of contemporary history and history of international relations at the Universität der Bundeswehr in Munich. In the course of his career, he's written about cultural memory, colonialism, international relations, and coming to terms with the past.
Hallo.
Ja, super, okay. Viele Grüße aus Berlin und vielen Dank für Ihre Zeit. Also leider haben wir nicht so viel Zeit zusammen, also ich würde vorschlagen, dass wir mit dem Interview losgehen. Ist das in Ordnung?
Mhm. Ja.
Okay, Dr. Jonas Andersen, möchten Sie sich kurz vorstellen?
Ja, ich bin wissenschaftlicher Mitarbeiter an der Universität der Bundeswehr in München, arbeite hier an der Professur für Zeitgeschichte und internationale Geschichte und in meiner Forschung beschäftige ich mich hauptsächlich mit Kolonialismus, mit Empires, mit der Geschichte der USA und Nordamerikas, setze mich aber auch in letzter Zeit recht viel mit Fragen zur Erinnerungskultur auseinander, also insbesondere jetzt so seit der Black Lives Matter Bewegung und den Denkmalstürzen und Protesten, die es gab, habe ich mich damit auch aus historischer Perspektive auseinandergesetzt und da einige Artikel geschrieben.
Vielen Dank für Ihre Zeit. Im Lauf Ihrer Karriere haben Sie sich viel mit dem Thema Erinnerungskultur beschäftigt und ich möchte Sie fragen, inwiefern ist Erinnerungskultur eine Identitätsfrage?
Ja, Erinnerungskultur ist in ganz entscheidendem Maße eine Identitätsfrage, vor allem wenn das Thema der kollektiven Identität geht. Und wenn wir über Erinnerungskultur sprechen, meinen wir ja auch in erster Linie das kollektive Erinnern, also die Erinnerungskultur von Gesellschaften, von Gemeinschaften. Natürlich spielen da auch individuelle Faktoren immer eine Rolle, also Gesellschaften an sich sind ja psychologisch nicht in der Lage, sich zu erinnern. Das ist natürlich ein Konstrukt, also der Prozess des Erinnerns spielt sich auf individueller Ebene ab, aber das, was wir als Erinnerungskultur beschreiben, ist natürlich in sehr hohem Maß an Gesellschaft gebunden. Und wenn wir ja da an Beispiel, zum Beispiel Denkmäler anschauen, also es sind ja sogenannte Symbolträger in der Erinnerungskultur, also sozusagen die Materialisierung von Erinnerungen, auch in Intentionen, und die zielen natürlich ganz stark auf ein kollektives Bewusstsein und sind retrospektiv, also in die Vergangenheit zeigen, identitätsstiftend, ja, sie sollen ein bestimmtes Bild von Geschichte vermitteln, von Werten, von Personen, die beispielsweise dann als Helden angesehen werden sollen, und sind insofern identitätsstiftend, als dass sie dann für eine gemeinsame Geschichte stehen, sind gleichzeitig aber auch prospektiv, also in die Zukunft weisend, handlungsleitend, ne, so eine Orientierung geben und aus dieser gemeinsamen Identität soll gemeinsam auch in die Zukunft gegangen werden. Also Identität Erinnerungskultur, es hängt unmittelbar zusammen und ist ein ganz, ganz wichtiger Bestandteil dessen. Auch in der Intention, Erinnerungskultur, die fällt ja nicht vom Himmel, die ist, die wird ausgehandelt, es stehen auch Interessen, Intentionen dahinter, und da geht es auch darum, ein ganz bestimmtes Bild eben von Geschichte zu vermitteln oder auch die Frage, ja, woran erinnern wir uns und wie eigentlich und warum nicht anders, ne? Das stehen natürlich immer Fragen dahinter, die auf Identität zielen.
Ja. Und Sie haben schon ein bisschen über Kolonialismus gesprochen. Kolonialismus ist natürlich ein sehr brennendes Thema, sowohl in Deutschland als auch in Großbritannien. Also deswegen möchte ich Sie fragen, wenn Länder wie Großbritannien auf Kolonialismus und auf der Sklaverei gegründet wurden, also Museen und Universitäten wurden dadurch finanziert, wie können diese Nationen die Vergangenheit bewältigen?
Es ist natürlich wichtig, sich mit dieser Vergangenheit auseinanderzusetzen, auch mit einem kritischen Blick, also auch mögliche Verklärungen oder Mythen zu hinterfragen. oder ein zu positiv kitschiges Bild auf die eigene Nationalgeschichte zu hinterfragen, zu dekonstruieren, gleichzeitig dabei aber auch nicht in einen Schuldkult zu verfallen und sozusagen die Vergangenheit nur von unserem Heute zu bemessen und dann zu verurteilen. Also ich denke, da ist auch der Blick für Ambivalenzen wichtig. Wenn wir konkret uns mit der kolonialen Vergangenheit auseinandersetzen, ist, denke ich, ein guter Ansatz, ein stärkerer Dialog auch mit ehemaligen Kolonien, also in der Vergangenheitsbewältigung oder in der Aufarbeitung dieser kolonialen Vergangenheit, das nicht als Einbahnstraße zu begreifen und das nur von der Metropole aus zu denken, sondern das im Dialog und in Zusammenarbeit mit ehemaligen Kolonien auch zu gestalten. Also wenn es um Museen beispielsweise geht, ist es immer so sinnvoll, einfach nur zu sagen, wir restituieren, wir geben also Kulturgüter einfach wieder zurück? Oder ist es nicht vielleicht so sinnvoller zu sagen, wir arbeiten gezielt mit Museen vor Ort zusammen, konzipieren vielleicht gemeinsame Ausstellungen? Ich habe das mal in Berlin im Humboldt-Forum dort gesprochen. Wurde auch gesagt, dass es beispielsweise mit Kamerun, dass es von dort als ehemalige deutsche Kolonie ein großes Interesse gab, zum Beispiel auch dann deutsche Gegenstände oder Objekte auszustellen dort, die größer war, als jetzt unbedingt alles wieder zu haben, was man aus Kamerun nach Deutschland gebracht hatte. Ja, also da herrscht auch nach wie vor eher so ein etwas paternalistischer Blick vor, finde ich, gerade mit Themen der Museen und der Sammlungen, dass sozusagen wir von unserer Position her ja annehmen, uns das Denken, na, dass wir in großer gönnerhafter Pose sozusagen die Dinge wieder zurückgeben können, dass vielleicht aber die Interessen ganz anders sind und dass da finde ich, auch ein stärkerer Dialog notwendig ist. Ja, und ich denke, gerade so Kulturzusammenarbeit, da könnte man viel machen, auch mit den ehemaligen Kolonien oder auch dort im Aufbau von Museen, Kooperation von Ausstellungen und so weiter. Glaube ich, mehr auf Partner, auf einer partnerschaftlichen Ebene zusammenarbeiten, als jetzt so diese ganze Geschichte der Aufarbeitung nur als aus unserer Perspektive zu sehen.
Ja, und Sie haben schon erwähnt, wie eng Erinnerungskultur mit der Identität eines Landes verbunden wird. Also, wenn Erinnerungskultur so stark von dem nationalen Narrativ eines Landes geprägt wird, wäre es möglich, eine transnationale Erinnerungskultur zu schaffen, also eine Erinnerungskultur sozusagen ohne Grenzen?
Da habe ich meine Zweifel. Das hängt zum einen damit zusammen, dass Geschichte natürlich nach wie vor sehr stark national geprägt ist. Das ist ja, Geschichte ist als Fachwissenschaft im 19. Jahrhundert ja vor allen Dingen als Legitimationswissenschaft für die neuen Nationalstaaten auch entstanden. Also dieser, wenn Sie an Reimke und so weiter zurückdenken, und das 19. Jahrhundert, das spielt eben die Nation eine ganz wichtige Rolle. Und das ist eben die Zeit der Geburt der modernen Nationalstaaten. Und da ist die Geschichtswissenschaft sehr stark mit verknüpft und das zieht sich bis heute durch, auch wenn wir natürlich transnationale Geschichte, Globalgeschichte haben als neuere methodische Ansätze, würde ich sagen, dass sich doch das lose Geschichtsbewusstsein in erster Linie national ist. Zum anderen habe ich ja schon gesagt, dass die Erinnerungskultur eigentlich in dem primären Zweck identitätsstiftend sein soll, also steht auch hier wie wieder auch in nationalen Traditionen, ne? Die Identitäten waren, sind in erster Linie national und auch die Lebensrealität der meisten Menschen spielt sich in den Nationen oder in den Regionen statt. Ja, für die wenigsten dürfte zutreffen, dass sie tatsächlich eine Lebensrealität als Weltbürger haben. Ich glaube, das ist nur für eine kleine Minderheit. Aber was man sicher sagen kann, ist zum Beispiel, dass wenn wir uns auf Europa schauen, in der Lebensrealität, gerade der Jüngeren, spielt Europa eine immer wichtigere Rolle. Das ist was sie in ihrem Leben, in ihrem Alltag erfahren, ja, gerade auch im Wegfall der innereuropäischen Grenzen im Schengen-Raum. Und da könnte ich mir schon denken, dass es auch zumindest partiell in einigen Themenbereichen sinnvoll ist, eine europäische Erinnerungskultur auch zu forcieren oder voranzubringen, dass es auch möglich ist. Gerade wenn man sowas wie Kolonialismus zum Beispiel als eine gesamteuropäische Vergangenheit betrachtet und jetzt nicht als britische, französische oder deutsche mit den jeweiligen Besonderheiten, sondern sagt, ja, das ist etwas, was ganz Europa betroffen hat. Selbst die Länder, die keine Kolonien formal hatten, waren am Kolonialismus beteiligt. Insofern würde ich hier die Aufarbeitung, wäre das sicherlich auch ein Gewinn, wenn man das aus einer europäischen Perspektive angehen würde. Aber jetzt sage ich mal, eine grenzenlose oder globale Erinnerungskultur kann ich mir nur schwer vorstellen, einfach weil es ja, dann eben im Zusammenhang mit diesen Identitätsfragen auch die Lebensrealität der Menschen nicht trifft.
Ja, und die internationalen Beziehungen spielen eine sehr große Rolle in der Erinnerungskultur. Also was bedeutet Brexit für Erinnerungskultur in Großbritannien?
Da kann ich, glaube ich, nur schwierig darauf antworten. Ich glaube, das ist auch noch etwas früh für eine Beurteilung, den Brexit als jetzt schon auch die Erinnerungskultur. Das sind Prozesse, die recht langsam und stetig ablaufen. Was ich mir vorstellen könnte, ist, dass es entsteht, das, was anschließend an das, was ich gerade gesagt habe, das ist also eher die, ja, sowas wie eine gemeinsame europäische Erinnerungskultur eher erschweren dürfte, zumindest aus britischer Perspektive, und da vielleicht dann stärker auch eine Verortung Großbritannien und dem Empire eben stattfindet. Es wurde ja im Zusammenhang mit dem Brexit jetzt auch immer wieder Stimmen, die sagten, na, das ist letztendlich, löst sich Großbritannien von Europa, es ist ja eh nicht Teil des europäischen Festlandes sozusagen, sondern es gibt auch Stimmen, die sagen, ja, eher gerade durch den Kolonialismus ist es eher eine maritime asiatische Macht fast. Und insofern könnte ich mir vorstellen, dass das auf lange Sicht eine Rolle spielt, dass es da nicht zu einer Integration dieser Perspektiven kommt, um einen Kolonialismus sozusagen als gesamteuropäisch bezeichnet, sondern hier dann eher das britische Empire in der Erinnerung im Fokus steht.
Ja. Und wir haben schon darüber gesprochen, wie die Erinnerungskultur ein sehr starkes emotionales Thema ist. Und ich interessiere mich dafür, wie die Erinnerungskultur eines Landes in der Politik instrumentalisiert wird. Also zum Beispiel, bevor dem Brexit-Referendum wurde Vorurteile gegen Deutschland in den Medien sehr sichtbar. Es gab Schilder zum Beispiel, die die deutsche Sprache beleidigten, und auch ein digital überarbeitetes Bild von Merkel, in dem sie einen Hitlergruß macht. Diese Bilder instrumentalisierten das nationale Narrativ Großbritanniens, in dem Deutschland immer noch als aggressiver Feind gilt, um diese Europhobie in Großbritannien zu verstärken. Und dabei WählerInnen natürlich zu beeinflussen. Inwiefern sind Erinnerungskulturen ein Instrument für die Politik?
Ja, gerade in dem Fall, wenn es um Stereotype geht, werden die natürlich genutzt, wenn immer sie passen, also insbesondere als Feindbilder. Und die beruhen natürlich auch auf einer kollektiven Erinnerung, die sich eingeprägt hat. Na, es ist nun mal so, dass die meisten europäischen Länder 20. Jahrhundert, vor allem im Zweiten Weltkrieg, dann enorm unter Deutschland gelitten haben. Insofern ist dieses Bild der Nazis, der Deutschen als Nazis, als Aggressoren, als Verbrecher und natürlich auch sehr stark in die Erinnerungskultur eingegangen, eben als dieses Stereotyp. Auch wenn ich sagen würde, dass es im Alltag vielleicht nicht mehr die große Rolle spielt, gerade unter jüngeren Leuten, haben wir da eigentlich eine sehr insgesamt in Europa eher Umformung eingenommen halt. Aber im politischen Streit oder da, wenn es uns gerade nützlich ist, greift man dann natürlich gerne zu. Und das ist ja nicht nur in Großbritannien so. Also Deutschland ist als größtes Land in der EU ja immer in einer schwierigen Position und in viele Konflikte dann auch verwickelt, wenn es um Interessen geht. Und da werden natürlich dann gerne diese Schablonen aus der Weltkriegserfahrung rausgezogen und diese Feindbilder benutzt. Also als die Finanzkrise hatten und den drohenden Kollaps von Griechenland da hat man auch sehr stark in Griechenland eben diese Bilder gehabt von den Deutschen als Nazis, und die in dieser Situation hier eben auf Einhaltung von Sparmaßnahmen und von Verbindlichkeiten dann zielten. Insofern haben wir das in unterschiedlichen Situationen, gerade in diesen innereuropäischen Konflikten mit Deutschland als größten Mitgliedstaat der EU immer wieder genutzt. Wir sehen es auch in anderen Bereichen, wenn man an den Krieg in der Ukraine gerade denken, auch da wird ja sehr stark von russischer Seite diese Nazi-Thematik bemüht und die Ukraine und die ukrainische Führung sozusagen als ein Loch von Nazis dort oder ein Pool von Nazis bezeichnet oder dargestellt. Also es ist natürlich aufgrund dieser prägenden Kraft dieser Zeit, ne, und dieser drastischen Verbrechen und Erfahrungen, die dort gemacht wurden, ist das natürlich ein sehr starkes Bild, was dann einfach auch genutzt wird, ne, also von verschiedenen Seiten.
Und Sie haben schon ein bisschen darüber gesprochen, dass Täter und Opfer eine sehr große Rolle in der Darstellung der Geschichte spielen. Also welche Rolle spielt Schuld in der Erinnerungskultur eines Landes?
Traditionell eher eine geringere, was natürlich auch wieder damit zusammenhängt, dass Erinnerungskultur als Identifikationsangebot letztlich positiv sein soll. Gerade wenn wir an Nationen denken, liegt es auf der Hand, dass man sich keine negative Identifikation schaffen wollte. Insofern haben wir eher auch eine Verklärung der Vergangenheit, haben Heldenmythen und Ausblenden von Schattenseiten. Ja, das ist, glaube ich, ganz, ganz prägend. Und auch wenn man es in die koloniale Vergangenheit und Verbrechen denkt, ist das ja auch was jetzt erst in den letzten Jahren eigentlich aufbröckelt und gemeinhin eher als positiv betrachtet wurde. Die einzig große Ausnahme, die mir bekannt ist, ist eben der Umgang mit dem Holocaust, also Deutschland und seine Erinnerungskultur, die ja ganz stark eben von dieser Vergangenheitsbewältigung geprägt ist und wo einfach dieser Zivilisationsbruch des Holocaust, des Völkermords an den europäischen Juden eine ganz zentrale Rolle einnimmt, letztlich auch konstitutiv für das Selbstverständnis ist. Und allem, was damit zusammenhängt, also auch das uneingeschränkte Bekenntnis zum Staat Israel beispielsweise, wird natürlich abgeleitet aus dieser historischen Erfahrung, aus diesem Nie wieder, was man dann letztendlich plakativ daraus ziehen kann. Also das ist so die Schuld, die Anerkennung dieser Verbrechen spielt in der deutschen Erinnerungskultur eine wichtige Rolle. Darüber hinaus würde ich sagen, eher eine untergeordnete. Also das kann sich natürlich ändern. Also der Blick auf koloniale Vergangenheit ist in letzter Zeit kritischer geworden, sehr kritisch teilweise. Und insofern kippt das vielleicht gerade etwas, dass auch die Schuld in den Fokus gerät. Aber traditionell, würde ich sagen, ist Erinnerungskultur immer ja irgendwie ein positives Identifikations.
Und natürlich ist die Geschichte auch eine Frage der Wahrheit und wie viele Wahrheiten es über die Geschichte geben könnte. Also im Laufe der Pandemie sahen wir alle, wie Wahrheit verkompliziert werden kann. Es gab so viele Verschwörungstheorien, dass die Glaubwürdigkeit von vielen Menschen, sogar Wissenschaftler und Ärzte, immer wieder in Frage gestellt. Wenn die Frage der Wahrheit, insbesondere in den Medien, so einfach manipuliert werden kann, wie können wir sicherstellen, dass die Geschichte nicht als relativ gesehen wird?
Ja, nun ist Geschichte natürlich keine Naturwissenschaft. Insofern ist diese Frage der Objektivität, kann immer nur so eine Zielvorgabe sein, die nie erreicht werden kann. Und Geschichte ist ja immer nicht die Wiedergabe der Vergangenheit, sondern die Interpretation der Überreste, die wir aus der Vergangenheit haben. Ja, das ist insofern schon mal eine andere Ausgangslage. Dann ist natürlich wichtig, gute Fachwissenschaft zu haben. Also Leute, die seriös mit Quellen arbeiten, die belegen, die nicht ins Blaue hineinplaudern, sondern auf Grundlage wirklich von Fakten argumentieren, das auch nachprüfbar machen. Dann glaube ich, was auch ganz wichtig ist, dass wir uns nicht völlig verabschieden von den großen Erzählungen, von den großen Strängen, auf die man sich sozusagen als Fundament einigen kann. Es ist ja schon so ein bisschen die Tendenz dazu, die Geschichte in viele Mikro-Einzelteile zu zerlegen großen Erzählungen zu dekonstruieren. Aber ich glaube, dass wir davon ausgehen, dass Gesellschaften auch Geschichte brauchen, zu ihrer eigenen Orientierung, auch für die eigene Identität, dann ist es durchaus wichtig, dass wir auch die großen Bögen sehen können und die auch interpretieren und nicht die Geschichte zu sehr zerstückeln und jeglichen Ansatz von großer Erzählung direkt verurteilen oder ablehnen, sondern uns bewusst sind, ja, dass an Dingen wie Fortschritt oder wie Aufklärung oder Moderne durchaus was dran ist, wo es sich lohnt, drüber nachzudenken.
Ja, und wie wir schon erwähnt haben, es gibt immer so viele Debatten darüber, inwiefern die Geschichte subjektiv oder objektiv ist. Deswegen möchte ich fragen, können wir eine Perspektive über Geschichte verneinen oder schadet das die Meinungsfreiheit?
Natürlich gibt es immer verschiedene Perspektiven. Also jeder, das sehen Sie auch zum Beispiel daran, welche Themen oder welche Ansätze gerade zu welchen Zeiten in der Geschichtswissenschaft populär sind. Da spiegelt sich immer die Gegenwart drüber. Also da sehen Sie automatisch, dass Sie in den 80er Jahren beispielsweise kam die Umweltgeschichte groß raus, ein Thema, in dem sich die Gesellschaft auch anfing, stärker mit Umweltthemen zu beschäftigen. Aktuell haben wir die Globalgeschichte so seit den späten 90ern, früh 2000, an eben in einer Zeit, wo Globalisierung für jeden greifbar wird eigentlich. Gesellschaft. Also da spiegelt sich schon mal sowieso die Fragen, die wir an die Geschichte stellen, die kommen letztlich aus dem Heute, insofern sind die verschiedenen Perspektiven natürlich gar nicht zu verhindern. Ja? Und das spielt natürlich immer mit rein. Trotzdem würde ich nicht sagen, dass Geschichte dadurch nur so völlig relativ und individuell und beliebig wird, sondern das sind ja auch immer Dinge, die gesellschaftliche Relevanz haben, ja? und die sich dann darin widerspiegeln. Also, diese Problematik, glaube ich, sehe ich jetzt gar nicht so, weil es jetzt nicht der Fall ist, dass sozusagen jeder die Geschichte für sich schreibt oder macht oder betrachtet, sondern wir ja schon da auch immer wieder eine gesellschaftliche Resonanz haben.
Ja, also Dr. Jonas Andersson, das war eigentlich meine letzte Frage. Ich habe unser Gespräch wirklich genossen. Vielen Dank für Ihre Zeit.
Ja, gerne. Vielen Dank Ihnen für die Fragen.
Now you will hear our second story. This story is about the Lancaster Squadron 460, which consisted of 8 men. Pilot James Herbert John English, Sergeant W.L. Miller, Navigator Neville Jack Anderson, Sergeant Arthur Wellesley Catty, Sergeant Arthur George Cole, Sergeant Ivan Roden, and Sergeant Alexander Elias Kahn. The Lancaster bomber flew into Berlin at 16:44 from Lincolnshire, a county in the East Midlands of the UK. During the night, 15,000 tons of bombs were dropped over Berlin. As a result of the heavy thunderstorm, many squadrons were blown by the wind far away from their intended targets. War correspondents were also present during this attack on Berlin. Journalist and announcer Edward R. Morrow and Lowell Bennett of the International News Service accompanied Squadron 50, while journalist Nordahl Bruun Grieg of the Daily Mail, along with Norman Stockton of the Australian Associated News, flew with Squadron 460 of the Royal Australian Air Force. However, they never arrived in Berlin. Flight Officer Jack Anderson reported on the bomber's crash on the 3rd of December 1943. There was a fatal burst from underneath causing fires. Incendiaries in bomb bay and port inner tank AC later a fire astern also. No order to abandon the aircraft was given, only words from pilot, "Stick with it, boys." My sincere belief that pilot was endeavouring to crash aircraft on target, but it was too well ablaze. Portside tailplane burnt off when aircraft went into spiral dive. Then something, probably PI tank, blew up and I was blown out. Rear gunner Flight Sergeant Kahn, AE, shot in legs in first attack and unable to leave turret as Dorn strand, unable to help him as evasive action too violent to move back. Also hoping to shake off fighter flight engineer Sergeant Miller A, RAF, nicked on leg by bullet but blown out too, and bomb aimer flight Sergeant Catty A, RAF, also blown out. The tailplane had burnt away and the whole bomber descended into a spiral dive. A large explosion followed. The tail gunner, as Anderson described, sustained injuries to his legs and could not kick open the doors of the aircraft. Flight engineer Sergeant Miller and bombardier Flight Sergeant Catty were catapulted out of the aircraft. Experts believe that the crash site was 12 miles southeast of Markbrandenburg. Anderson and Catty survived the crash, with Anderson later describing how he walked 12 miles, just under 20 kilometres, until he hid in a farmhouse after the crash. However, he was quickly found and taken prisoner of war with fellow Flight Sergeant Catty. Two bodies landed in Paderdam near Brandenburg. Three other bodies landed in Prutska, also a district of municipality of Klosterlehnen in Brandenburg. Only Anderson and Catty were able to parachute to safety. Of the four war correspondents taken on the operation, only one returned, Ed Morrow. Norman Stockton and Johann Krief were killed, while Lowell Bennett was taken prisoner of war. Morrow recounted his experience on the 3rd of December 1943 with a moving radio announcement commemorating the fallen from the two squadrons. The announcement also recounts the horrors of war and is called Orchestrated Hell. Here, a small excerpt from the announcement.
"This is London. Yesterday afternoon, the waiting was over. The weather was right. The target was to be the big city. The crew captains walked into the briefing room, looked at the maps and charts, and sat down with their big celluloid pads on their knees. The atmosphere was that of a school and a church. The weatherman gave us the weather. The pilots were reminded that Berlin is Germany's greatest center of war production. The intelligence officer told us how many heavy and light attack guns, how many searchlights we might expect to encounter. Then, Jock, the wing commander, explained the system of markings, the kind of flare that would be used by the pathfinders. He said that concentration was the secret of success in these raids, and that as long as the aircraft stayed well bunched, they would protect each other. The captains of aircraft walked off. I noticed that the big Canadian, with the slow, easy grin, had printed Berlin at the top of his pad and then embellished it with a scroll. The red-headed English boy with the teenage gold mustache was the last to leave the room. Late in the afternoon, we went to the locker room to draw parachutes, Mae Wests, and all the rest. As we dressed, a couple of the Australians were whistling. Walking out to the bus that was to take us to the aircraft, I heard the station loudspeakers announcing that evening, all personnel would be able to see a film, Star Spangled Rhythm, 3. We went out and stood around a big black four-motored Lancaster, D for dog. A small station wagon delivered a thermos bottle of coffee, chewing gum, an orange, and a bit of chocolate for each man. Up in that part of England, the air hums and throbs with the sound of aircraft motors all day. But for half an hour before takeoff, the skies are dead, silent, and expectant. A lone hawk hovered over the airfield, absolutely still as he faced into the wind. Jack, the tail gunner, said, it would be nice if we could fly like that. Doc looked at his watch and moved toward the aircraft. Nothing was said. We all followed. His dog eased around the perimeter track to the end of the runway. We sat there for a moment. The green light flashed, and we were rolling, 10 seconds ahead of schedule. The takeoff was smooth as silk. The wheels came up, and D-Dog started the long climb. As we came up through the crowd, I looked right and left and counted 14 black Lancasters climbing for a place where men must burn oxygen to live. The sun was going down, and its red glow made rivers of lakes of fire on top of the crowd. Down to the southward, the crowd piled up to form castles, battlements, and whole cities, all tinged with red. Soon we were out over the North Sea. Dave, the navigator, asked Johnson if he couldn't make a little more speed. We were nearly 2 minutes late. By this time, we were all using oxygen. The talk on the intercom was brief and crisp. Everyone sounded relaxed. For a while, the eight of us in our little world in exile moved over the sea. There was a quarter moon on the beam. Josh's quiet voice came through the intercom. That'll be flat ahead. We were approaching the enemy post. The flat looked like a cigarette lighter in a dark room. One that won't light. Spark, but no flame. The spark crackling just above the level of the cloud top. He flew steady and straight. And seeing the flat was directly below us. The dog rocked a little from right to left. But that wasn't caused by the flat. We were in the slipstream of other Lancasters ahead. And we were over the enemy coast. And then a strange thing happened. The aircraft seemed to grow smaller. Jack in the rear turret, Wally, the mid-upper gunner, Pitch, the wireless operator, all seemed somehow to draw closer to Jock in the cockpit. It was as though each man's shoulder was against the other's. The understanding was complete. The intercom came to life, and Jock said, two aircraft on the 14. Jack in the tail said, okay, sir, relax. The whole crew was a unit and wasn't wasting words. The cloud below was 10 cents. The blue-green jet of the exhaust licked back along the leading edge. And there were other aircraft all around us. The whole bright aerial armada was hurtling towards Berlin. We flew so for 20 minutes. When Jock looked up at a vapor trail curling across above us, remarking in a conversational tone that from the look of it, he thought there was a fighter up there. Occasionally, the angry red of Akash burst through the clouds, but it was far away, and we took only an academic interest. We were flying in the third wave. Jock asked Wally in the mid-upper turret and Jack in the rear turret if they were cold. They said they were all right and thanked him for asking. He even asked how I was, and I said, all right so far. The cloud was beginning to thin out. Off to the north, we could see light, and the flak began to liven up ahead of us. Buzz, the bomb aimer, crackled through on the intercom. There's a battle going on the starboard beam. We couldn't see the aircraft, but we could see the jets of red tracer being exchanged. Suddenly, there was a burst of yellow flame, and Jock remarked, that's a fighter going down. Note the position. The whole thing was interesting, but remote. Dave, the navigator, who was sitting back with his charts and compasses, said, the attack ought to begin in exactly 2 minutes. We were still over the clouds. But suddenly, those dirty gray clouds turned white. We were over the outer searchlight defenses. The clouds below us were white and we were black. D-Dog seemed like a black bug on a white sheet. The flak began coming up. The hum of it spoke. We were still a long way from Berlin. I didn't realize just how far. Jock observed, there's a kite on fire dead ahead. It was a great golden, slow-moving meteor slanting towards the earth. By this time, we were about 30 miles from our target area in Berlin. That 30 miles was the longest flight I have ever made. Dead on time, Buzz, the bomb aimer, reported, target indicators going down. At the same moment, the sky ahead was lit up by bright yellow flares. Off to starboard, another kite went down in flames. The flares were spouting all over the sky, reds and greens and yellows, and we were flying straight for the center of the fireworks. D-Dog seemed to be standing still, the four propellers striking the air. But we didn't seem to be closing in. The cloud had cleared, and off to the starboard, a lank was caught by at least 14 searchlight beams. You could see him twist and turn and finally break out. But still, the whole thing had a quality of unreality about it. No one seemed to be shooting at us, but it was getting lighter all the time. Suddenly, a tremendous big blob of yellow light appeared dead ahead, another to the right and another to the left. We were flying straight for them. Jock pointed out to me the dummy fires and flares to right and left, but we kept going in. Dead ahead, there was a whole chain of red flares, looking like stoplights. Another lamp was coned on our starboard beam. The light seemed to be supporting it. Again, we could see those little bubbles of colored lead driving at us from two sides. The German fighters were at it. And then, with no warning at all, the dog was filled with an unhealthy white light. I was standing just behind Jock and could see all the scenes on the wing. His quiet Scotch voice beat into my ears. Steady, lad. We've been pwned. His slender body lifted, half out of the seat, as he jammed the control column forward and to the left. We were going down. Jock was wearing woolen gloves with the fingers cut off. I could see his fingernails turn white as he gripped the wheel. And then I was on my knees, flat on the deck, where he had whipped the dog back into a climbing turn. The knees should have been strong enough to have seemed in some danger of letting me down, too. I picked myself up and looked out again. It seemed that one big searchlight, instead of being 20,000 feet below, was mounted right on our wingtip. The dog was corkscrewing. As he rolled down on the other side, I began to see what was happening for Lynn. The clouds were gone, and the sticks and incendiaries from the preceding waves made the place look like a badly laid out city with the streetlights on. The small incendiaries were going down like a fistful of white rice thrown on a piece of black velvet. As Jock hauled the dog up again, I was thrown to the other side of the cockpit, and there below were more incendiaries, glowing white and then turning red. The cookies, the 4,000-pound high explosives, were bursting below like great sunflowers gone mad. And then as we started down again, still held in the light, I remembered that the dog still had one of those cookies and a whole basket of incendiaries in his belly, and the light still held it. And I was very frightened.
I chose these two stories because I believe they convey the strong camaraderie of the men who gifted each other loyalty, courage, and kindness despite the horrors of the Second World War. They gifted each other kindness in a world that had lost all humanity. I hope that in this episode, I told the stories of Lancaster Squadron 460 and Lancaster Squadron 625 with humanity, respect, and compassion. To conclude the podcast, we have an interview with Dr. Rachel O'Sullivan concerning the role of guilt in history. Dr. Rachel O'Sullivan is a researcher at the Center for Holocaust Studies at the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich. In the course of her career, O'Sullivan's research has focused primarily on the Holocaust and National Socialism. Today, I would like to ask her about the role of perpetrators and victims in history, and also the central question of guilt and responsibility within a country's culture of remembrance. The following interview is conducted in English. The text of the interview in German and English are, as ever, available in the description below. Dr. Rachel O'Sullivan, would you like to briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah, firstly, thank you very much for having me. My name is Rachel O'Sullivan. I'm from Dublin, Ireland, but since 2019, I've been working at the Leibniz Institute for Contemporary History in Munich. Specifically, I work in a department or a center called the Center for Holocaust Studies. And so we research the history of the Holocaust, but also the wider contexts of the Holocaust. Did my PhD in Edinburgh University. I looked at colonial discourses, basically in relation to Poland during the Third Reich, and also in relation to Africa. And then from that, I've written my first book that will come out in November with Bloomsbury. And so I concentrated on population policies in annexed Poland during the Second World War, but from a colonial perspective. So basically using colonial examples and colonial literature to investigate and sort of highlight different parts of the Nazi regime in Poland.
Thank you so much for your time. It's so exciting for us to have you here, and you were really the perfect person to have this interview with, because I've been looking to talk to someone about the relationship between cultural memory, guilt, and the role of sort of victims and perpetrators in history, because they're always so important in the telling of history, but also sometimes they can get very political. And obviously history is a very emotional subject, but it's also important to make sure that we're not telling a biased narrative about history, if that's at all avoidable, because it's so difficult when history is so subjective anyway. So my first question is about the role of guilt in history, and I was just wondering, what do you think the role of guilt is in cultural memory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. It's quite a hard one to start off with, I guess, because on one hand, I suppose guilt isn't always, a helpful concept, because it is something emotional, and to talk of collective guilt is also a little bit difficult, because it kind of assumes this collectivity almost. It's not really picking up on individuals necessarily. And so I think sometimes maybe instead of guilt, we can think about it a bit more in terms of something like responsibility, to bring that emotional level out of it a little bit. And that sort of responsibility, both in terms of that my nation or my country perhaps did something bad in the past, either an event or a series of events or crimes, but also responsibility in terms of how we today look back on the past. So not only just recognizing what has happened, but also taking on this responsibility to engage with it and think about it and think about how it shaped us today and how it shaped how we think about ourselves or political systems. But again, in a way, it still links to the emotional side. This responsibility, it comes from a place of recognizing something that has happened and trying to move forward with it, essentially, in a positive way.
Yeah, I think that's really important, that it's always really difficult to talk about a nation's cultural memory, and also quite difficult to construct these stories because they are so emotional and they're so intimately tied to people's own families and people's own lives. And so I think it's really difficult. We talked a little bit about telling stories without prejudice and whether it's actually possible to tell history without these prejudices. And I think that's even evident in archival work. So sort of what documents are considered valid and worth keeping. So I found that in the course of this project, for example, it's so much easier to find military documents compared to information about civilians, because they've got responsible bodies for them, whereas civilians, you know, were tragically killed in all sorts of accidents as well that weren't part of particular operations. And so I just wanted to ask you, is it possible to tell history without prejudice, and how can we seek to make archives more of a neutral place, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and also a tough one, I guess, because in a way, a lot of history is also the history of prejudice. I mean, if you look at Germany, of course, it's obvious with the Second World War, with anti-Semitism, but also if you look further back to the Kaiserreich, Germany has a colonial history, and not, you know, quite a violent one. If you look at the British Empire, it's also the same, this sort of categorization of people and cultures and saying, you know, maybe what culture is better and what one can sort of be allowed to disappear almost. I think also in terms of how we do history in a way is also a little bit prejudiced, because it's not only, I suppose, you know, not only the winners write the history, but also a lot of the time occupiers write history, and that's reflected in history today. It's usually this white Western perspective. I'm coming from a field of Holocaust studies. It is very international, but at the same time, it's lacking in diversity in a lot of cases and a lot of institutions, and that also moves to archives and the people who are teaching in universities. And so in a way, it's sort of almost like these two different sides to history, both in the past and in the present, what we do with it. But I suppose maybe a positive spin on it, or a way forward, is to start really opening the field, essentially opening in, allowing in more groups to speak, listening to voices that maybe necessarily wouldn't have been heard before. I think recently, obviously, there's been this movement in Britain, for example, but also in other European cities to decolonize the city landscape, decolonize institutions. And I think that's a really important sort of, almost like a, it's not a starting point because it's already been done, but this is something that really caught people's attention, especially young people. And I think we can actually further use this. And it's not about canceling, I don't like that word. It's about really taking these structures that we know exist and that we know are influenced by prejudice and really pulling them apart and saying, what can we do differently? And who can we invite to the table to get different opinions and ask different questions as well? And that it's as important in academic research, in museums, in politics, in archives. We really need to use this approach more widely, I think.
Yeah, and I think that it's really interesting you've talked about sort of the decolonial movement and sort of the development of post-colonial discourse. But I think that post-colonial discourse does still struggle a lot of the time with the kind of stark distinction between perpetrator and victim, and sort of the barrier between them is always kind of hard to define. Some cases not, but and I think that the question that I wanted to ask you was how important this sort of binary between perpetrator and victim is in the construction of a national narrative, and to what extent it's helpful and to what extent it's kind of unhelpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a really good case is Ireland. So I'm from Ireland, and we grew up learning our history from the viewpoint of the victim. So we were colonized by the British, we were the victim of the British, and that has really shaped Irish national identity. However, what hasn't really, it's only really recently being researched in academia, and it's certainly not really a part of the public narrative, but Irish people participated in empire as part of the British army, and that's really missing from our narratives of history. If we looked at that a bit more, it would, I guess, allow us to be open to different perspectives in Ireland. Ireland is becoming more and more diverse and multicultural, and so it's important to actually bring in narratives from other groups as well. You know, we aren't the only victims, we were also perpetrators as well, and so we need to some way find this balance. In Britain, I think it's quite interesting. So I did my PhD in the UK, and I think in a way the sort of British narrative is they've chosen sort of one tragedy to remember, one tragedy to call the Never Again, and that is the Holocaust. And that was not a British crime, that is a German crime, and certainly with European context, but a German crime. And so it's, in a way, it's a deflection. You know, you can blame the Germans for the Second World War, you can blame them for the Holocaust, that is the truth. But at the same time, you still need to approach these things with some self-reflection and say, you know, the Germans weren't the only ones who were violent in the 20th century, also earlier than that. And in Germany, of course, it's not necessarily blame, it's more so this responsibility. And they've done relatively well, I would say, in confronting this responsibility, taking it on and building it into their education system. And it's really, you know, in Germany, they don't really even say cultural memory, they sort of use this term originalmente culture. So like this real, it's a remembrance culture. It's like really embedded into the politics and institutions here. But at the same time, there can sometimes be a little bit of a division between Germans and Nazis and you know, who's who, and you know, the Nazis are Germans, but at the same time, not all Germans are Nazis. So there is also still this element within Germany itself. And yeah, I think it really goes back to critically reflecting on this. And it's something that in academia, I think, is done quite a lot, but we're maybe less good at influencing the public discussions on these things.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fascinating. It's really important that you've spoken a little bit about Ireland, but also the relationship between Britain and Germany, which is obviously very contentious still, I think. And there's still a lot of prejudice towards the German language in Britain. And as a student at school, I always found that I was always asked, why do I study German? And everyone sort of being shocked about me choosing to study German instead of French, because French is often the first foreign language you learn. In Britain, I feel like you can't raise the German language without it being in the same breath as National Socialism and the Second World War. So what role does Germany play in the construction of Britain's cultural memory, and in what ways is this role both constructive and destructive?
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting point that you made, and it kind of interestingly reminds me of Fawlty Towers, this TV show, and this episode where German tourists come and Basil Fawlty's sort of motto throughout the episode is "Don't mention the war," and we kind of have this also. I've seen it in Ireland too, almost like that we have to treat Germans or any discussions about Germany with a lot of sensitivity. You know, maybe like it's awkward to mention the war, it's awkward to mention the Holocaust, which actually isn't the case. I've been living in Germany for 7 years now. I know a lot of German people, I work with Germans. It's not a secret. It's something that they openly talk about, they're openly willing to discuss. I mean, of course, older generations probably wasn't the case, but certainly the younger generations, in the city landscape, you know, there's Holocaust memorials, there's museums, there's institutions like this Center for Holocaust Studies. So it's not hidden, it's not a taboo. And in a way, it's almost like, yeah, I'm not sure if it's a British, Irish, maybe it's an English language thing in a way, that we have this almost association with the German language, with the history of Germany, and therefore the history of the Second World War, these sort of connections, even though in reality in Germany, it's not like that at all. I think it might come down to how history is taught in the UK. I've heard it discussed quite a bit. Often in the UK, and I would say also in Ireland, the sort of perspective given to students is that, you know, that you identify with the victims, that the victims are just like us, when actually in reality, the perpetrators were also just like us. You know, Germans are modern, civilized and inverted commas society that commits this crime, and I think part of the problem with only identifying with the victims is that then you miss this self-reflection point, or a sort of national reflection point. In saying that, I do think that the UK has done well in terms of Holocaust education, you know, that can't be denied, and in a way I guess they've sort of fed from the German model a little bit, you know, using the Holocaust to also teach, to learn lessons, is sort of the famous sort of, I guess, line about racism, about this sort of dangerous discourse about the far right. But yeah, on the other side, I think we do have to be a bit careful about how Germany is potentially always blamed for this, when there are also many other events that potentially shaped the British national identity more than the Second World War did. That also being, you know, colonies, the Commonwealth, how they treated people from the Commonwealth. But it's an interesting point, and it's a tough one. Maybe I've also heard that actually since Brexit, the rate of foreign language learning in the UK has dropped, or at least in the last few years, even before Brexit, which is, it's unfortunate, really. Yeah, I can't really describe it any other way.
Yeah, and it's interesting when I think about my own experience. So this is the first time that I've come to Germany. I've always really loved studying German, but I did come here with that stereotype because I've never visited before of sort of, oh, don't talk about the war. And I thought, how on earth am I going to do this 6 week practicum, which is entirely about the Second World War, and not talk about the Second World War. I just thought, how am I going to actually do this? And I was really worried about sort of putting my foot in it. But like you say, there is this openness here that I think we don't have in the UK towards sort of the darker periods in our history and our violent past, in which that, like you say, everyone will very readily talk about the Holocaust. And of course, the Holocaust is a really terrible era of history that has really shaped where we are today. But also, you cannot suggest that our violent history of colonialism is not still deeply ingrained in our culture. I mean, if you look at, you know, I'm fully aware that where I study at a university is built through slavery. I know that, but it's about how we deal with that. And we can't, like you say, we can't cancel history, we can't sort of not talk about it. But I think that there is that narrative in Britain still that we need to address, which is why I think it's so interesting looking at German-British relations, because we were involved in the same conflict, obviously different sides, but the way we manage our own history and the way we manage our own responsibility with the violent eras of our past is very, very different. And so you talked about Brexit a little bit, and I think it's really interesting talking about what we've briefly mentioned about sort of the biases towards languages, because there's always the stereotype that, you know, why would you ever learn a modern foreign language, because everyone in Europe speaks English. But I've worked for the Goethe Institute, and I was part of the team that was really encouraging students to learn German, specifically at GCSE, so that they would then take it on to A-level. I did a few A-level classes as well. And I just think that it's really important to get people to question where that comes from, because it's not without accident that, you know, English is the work language, the global language. Sort of, where has that come from? It's come from imperialism. And do we really want to be perpetuating that through the way we learn languages and the way that we deal with other cultures? And I think it's really important to get students thinking about that, because it's not just a practical thing of everyone speaks English. It's just, where has that come from? That's come from, you know, really violent occupations. So anyway, I'm drifting from the question a little bit. But I was just thinking about Brexit, and we've talked a little bit about how that's affected language learning. How does the Brexit referendum inform an understanding of Great Britain's attitude towards cultural memory specifically?
I suppose I'm an outsider to Britain, and I have a very Irish informed perspective on it. My grandfather was from Northern Ireland, so I mean, when he was born, it was still, you know, counted as an integral part of Britain at the time. It wasn't the Northern Ireland that we know today. But I think to an extent, Brexit sort of moves from a point where it almost assumes that the nation is quite homogenous, you know, that Britain is British and that the people are British, and it has this maybe quite a narrow view, and to an extent that's also reflected in parts of the history almost, and when we look at how the approach to empire, for example, this idea that there were only good things about it, which of course is only from one perspective really. And so I think Brexit has in a way sort of both denied the reality of the diverse multicultural society that Britain is. It denies how this multiculturalism has shaped Britain and has shaped narratives. And I'm not just talking about, you know, people from the EU coming to Britain to work or to study, but also from former British colonies or from the Commonwealth, you know. It's a question actually sometimes that even comes up in Germany quite a lot, because recent studies have shown that around one in three, I think it is, or at least soon it will be one in three citizens in Germany have a migrationary background, so to speak. So they have a parent who's from abroad or grandparents. And so we see, you know, it's just the reality. Our societies are becoming more mixed, and in a way, our cultural memory also has to reflect that. It can't really continue, or at least in my mind, this remembrance culture can't really continue from a standpoint that, you know, Germany is only Germans or Britain is only British. It needs to start, we need to develop cultural memory that also reflects the reality of the society and that brings in the experiences and the narratives of other cultures. And we say to ourselves, you know, this Britain was once an empire that tried to destroy a lot of cultures. As an Irish person, you know, we almost lost our Irish language. I unfortunately can't speak that much. My surname is an anglicization of the original Irish name. And so it's really present still in Ireland. But I think in a way there needs to be recognition of this and to say, well, we need to bring these stories also into our national history because they've also made us who we are.
Yeah, and I think that's really important when you talk about sort of the, I sound so pessimistic about Great Britain, but I do just I do just worry about what Brexit says about our own cultural memory, in terms of there seems to be in Great Britain recently this sort of move towards isolationism again, and in a way that sort of Britain almost wants to be like America, very independent. But I think that it's important to acknowledge that that's actually, you know, quite dangerous if you think about what we've been talking about in terms of dialogue between different cultures. Isolationism is sort of how war comes about, and how these conflicts arise. So I just wanted to talk about the different vocabulary that nations develop to talk about the past. So in Great Britain and Germany, the vocabulary used to describe the fallen in both world wars is obviously very different. In Britain, there is a narrative of sacrifice and heroism, which forms quite a large part still of Great British patriotism and national identity. So what do you make of this national narrative, and is it possible to separate the heroisation of the fallen from perhaps the glorification of war?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think in Germany, I actually remember it was my first few visits to Germany, and we were in very small graveyards, and as kids we were kind of shocked that on some of the graves were pictures of people in, you know, Wehrmacht uniforms, for example, and for us this was quite strange. But of course at the end of the day it comes back to this whole thing of who's a Nazi and who's German, are they the same thing? In Germany, there's definitely more of an approach of, there's not really any glorification of war. I would even go as far to say that certainly with older generations, even patriotism was a bit hard for Germans. I know Germans are in, you know, the age of 30 or 40, and they wouldn't have always actually felt comfortable saying that they were patriotic. They would have rather said that they were European, as opposed to being German. And I think that actually ties in with this Second World War history, where of course you have, in Britain, it's something very different. There is certainly a narrative of Britain as a hero, as the hero, Britain alone standing up against the Germans. But the people who died in the war were heroes. And yeah, it's a very fine line between saying that people are heroes and then actually glorifying this violence. I think it also doesn't reflect the sacrifice perhaps of other communities. In a way, this idea of Britain's sacrifice kind of paints everyone with the same brush, and it's also a sort of way of homogenizing the war effort and not really recognizing that there were people from many different nationalities who also contributed to this effort from the Commonwealth. I know there are certainly thousands of of Irish people who also signed up for the British Army, and when they returned to Ireland, they were basically cast out as traitors, more or less, and they've sort of fallen out from history. And, you know, it's really about, and on one side, there's this hero narrative, but on the other side, there's many forgotten heroes, quote unquote, that aren't really reflected. And on the glorification side, I do think this ties in a little bit also with the imperial past in a way, that the British military or the British Army were almost like these bringers of hope or of civilization, of good. They fought the Germans, they, you know, conquered all these territories, etc. And I think it all sort of feeds into this narrative of this pride and this idea of sort of military sacrifice. So when it comes to the First World War, I think we stand back a little bit, and I'm not 100% sure why that is. I think there's a little bit more of this distance between the sort of militarized killing of the First World War and then the narrative of the Second World War, which is interesting in itself. But yeah, that's a bit of a sort of open answer. I'm not sure if it's really possible to separate it, but it needs to be discussed. That's definitely what I can say.
Yeah, I think that's really important when you talk about how actually sort of the memory of the Second World War in Britain is tied to sort of similar themes and similar sort of preferred national narratives about British identity and sort of British military prowess and sort of the British hero story. And I think that's interesting when we think about the term Commonwealth as well, because if you look at a lot of my work focuses around the 1939 to 1945 Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery in Berlin, and I always question, you know, what Commonwealth actually means, because the way that it's laid out, I mean, it's a product of its time, but you have all of the Western soldiers at the front, and then sort of the non-Western, non-white soldiers are in the very corner in the back. I just think, what does that say about the term Commonwealth? It's meant to be sort of this term that encompasses everyone and all the nations, but to what extent is it just sort of like a beautification of sort of imperialism as well, because they do just get what you call in German the Katzentisch at the back, and they're sort of, what does that suggest when we put, you know, all the Western people at the front and then all the non-Western soldiers at the back? So another question about Britain's attitude to overcoming the past, is it actually possible for Britain to overcome the past when its very foundations are so intricately intertwined with imperialism?
I think I also probably have come across very pessimistic in terms of Britain. Maybe realistic is a better word, I'm not sure. I mean, it's tough with the current, I mean, with Brexit, the current government, it is kind of, I suppose, maybe a bit tough to be optimistic about the future. I mean, I do hope that there is a way. I mean, if not to maybe overcome, sounds a bit like we always have to like fight with the past and then sort of succeed against this, maybe negotiate with the past in a way, or to come to terms with it. I think that there's the tools, like the tools are there. If you look at Germany, how did they approach Holocaust memory? How did they approach Holocaust education? You know, this is a German crime that they should have been feeling guilt for, yet they still managed to make it an integral sort of central point within their remembrance culture. So there's definitely ways and means to do it, but obviously there needs to be the will to do it. I think also, I think it was Tom Lawson who said that, you know, in Britain, colonial violence, it's not really hidden in a way from the landscape. Like you said, you know, you know that your university is sort of built through the proceeds of slavery, and the statues, there's items in museums, you know, it's all actually visually present for us to see, yet it's not engaged with. So I think the fact that it's there is, on one hand, okay, well, we have something to work with, but the work needs to be done. What I didn't mention is this planned Holocaust memorial that, I mean, it originally was proposed for the site and beside the Houses of Parliament, and it's gone through different legal stages, and now the British government have more or less said they're introducing more new legislation. So this huge new Holocaust memorial can be built, and an education centre, although there's already Holocaust memorials in Britain. And here we see again this sort of almost denial of the fact that there's another part of British history separate to the Holocaust, separate to the Second World War, that needs to be dealt with or negotiated with. And, you know, that money could probably be better spent on something like that. Or perhaps even if it has to be about the Second World War, then looking at things like the contribution of other nationalities. But they've been sort of glossed over in favor of sort of defaulting back again to a German crime. So on one hand, there just seems to be a will to pursue certain historical narratives and not others. As I said, I mean, Germany is an example. It took a while in Germany, but it happened. And I hope that it, I hope it goes that way in Britain. But yeah, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, I really hope so too. Yeah, we've spoken about the role of the nation and how the nation is actually sort of an imagined construct, but it plays such a vital part in how history is remembered, of course, but also in remembrance cultures as well. And I was just thinking, as a way of sort of tying this interview together, do you think it's possible to establish a transcultural memory, or what you may call a cultural memory or remembrance culture without borders?
That's a good question. I do think it's possible. And one of the reasons is, I mean, to an extent, actually, if we use the example of the Holocaust, certainly in academic research, we're moving towards this idea of the Holocaust not only being a German crime, but really this strong level of European participation, that it happens across borders. It's not only Germany, it's Romania, it's the Netherlands, it's France. So I think on one hand, we've already done something a little bit similar. Now it still does need to be embedded a bit better into public remembrance culture, but it's slowly happening. I think if we look at other countries, what is a link is often this sort of imperial or colonial history that actually connects a lot of countries to each other. You know, whether those connections are initially, I mean, not very bad connections. For example, the connections between Ireland and Britain, certainly from the Irish side, it's not seen as a really good connection. But still, at the same time, I think a more sort of transnational remembrance culture does really bind nations in a different way, and also it's also a sign. It's a sign that shows that regardless of your nationality, or regardless of, you know, if your parents came from a different country or your grandparents, that the sort of narrative of the nation's history still embraces this diversity. It still is open to recognizing how the nation is informed by other people and by its interactions with other nations, and I think that's very important.
Rachel Sullivan, that's actually my final question. Thank you so much for your time. It's been such an interesting discussion. Thank you so much for bringing the Irish perspective as well. That's really interesting.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for this discussion. I've really, really enjoyed it, and I hope you have too.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, and also well done on what seems like a really, really interesting and, of course, extremely important topic. Yeah, it was great to talk to you.
That was a fascinating discussion. If you'd like to find out more about Lancaster Squadron 460, Lancaster Squadron 625, Dr. Jonas Anderson, or Dr. Rachel O'Sullivan, please see the links below. In the next episode of the podcast, we have interviews with military historian Dr. Lieb and museum director Jan Bezevec. And as ever, you will hear the stories of the fallen, this time those of Lancaster Squadron 106 and Lancaster Squadron 467. My name is Holly Perrell, and that was the second episode of Our Shared History, War Personnel of the Commonwealth Remembered.